Exodus 32, verses 15 through 29. Last week, we began this study in this lamentable episode in the history of God's older covenant people, the story of the golden calf, the bull calf, and the worshiping of other gods. We're picking up now where we left off after verse 14. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and on the back they were written. And notice verse 16, the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. There's a reason why that was stipulated. We'll talk about that. When Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, and let's again stop here at verse 17, some scholars speculate that Moses and Joshua have been up on this mountain for the better part of a month. Joshua went up part of the way. Moses went up to the peak of the mountain where he met with Yahweh. So verse 17, when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is a noise of war in the camp." But he, Moses, parenthesis, my insertion, having already been informed by the Lord what was really going on, but he, Moses, said, "It is not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear." And as soon as he came near the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing. Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. Again, let me stop here. You may have a study Bible with a lot of study notes, ESV study Bible, New Reformation study Bible. They give various reasons as to why this drinking of the ground-up calf bull was done. We don't really know for sure. It's possible that Moses was humiliating the people by doing this. It's also possible that he's saying, this is what your idol worship is worth. You drink this and you're going to excrete it out of your body, kind of thing. Verse 21, and Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you brought such a great sin upon them?" And Aaron said, "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, they are set on evil. For they said to me, 'Make us gods who shall go before us.' As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And so I said to them, "Let any of you who have gold take it off." And so they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Yeah, that's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? We'll have more to say about that. Verse 25, and when Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose. Notice where the responsibility lies. Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered around him. And he said to them, "Thus says Yahweh, God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from the camp to gate, from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother, his companion, and his neighbor." And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And that day, about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, "Today you have been ordained for the service of Yahweh, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day." And there ends the reading of God's authoritative, infallible word. Back in the early 1900s, there was an Iowa singing group. They were really what was known as a vaudeville act called the Cherry Sisters. And following one of their concerts or their performances, a reporter for the Des Moines Register newspaper ran a scathing, contemptuous review in which he wrote the following. "Their long, skinny arms, equipped with talons at the extremities, wave frantically at the suffering audience. The mouths of their rancid features open like caverns and sounds like the wailing of condemned souls issued therefrom." Well, not surprisingly, the Cherry Sisters sued the newspaper for libel. And really, from what I was able to determine, what was a landmark decision on the issue of freedom of the press, It went to the Iowa Supreme Court, and the presiding judge, as a part of rendering a decision, asked the Cherry Sisters to perform the particular act or song in his court. And after hearing it, he ruled in the newspaper's favor. Now, obviously, their singing was not that good. Their singing was little more than noise. Now, in our text this morning, we have Moses coming down from this mountain. He's just been given the tablets of the law, and he's only about halfway down when he and Joshua hear something. And look again at verse 17. I'll read it from the New American Standard this time. Now, when Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There's the sound of war in the camp." And as we learned last time, and as Moses indicates, this is pretty far from noise of war. Joshua, of course, never suspected that the people would be engaging in a fertility cult ritual with a golden bull calf. So he assumed it must be an attack upon the camp. Now, as I indicated when I read it, there are some estimates that Moses and Joshua were on the mountain for quite a few weeks. And we covered last week what this whole thing was all about, what these people were actually doing. And today, we're going to see more of the consequences of those actions that you've already read. And they're very severe, aren't they? But look, at this point, let's be reminded of this much. Those people were blending together, at least attempting to, the worship of Yahweh, the true God, and the worship of pagan gods. And there are several names for this effort. People continue to do this, whether they make a golden bull calf or not. One of the terms is syncretism. We've actually talked about this before because it's already come up in our study, early studies in the book of Exodus. But there's a more familiar term, and that is the term pluralism. That's all over the place in our world today. Pluralism is the, in the case of religion and theology, it is the combining of gods and beliefs from differing religions. I think I've referenced this before. You may see, I don't know, I've never done the study, maybe like one out of every 15 or 20 automobiles, maybe even not that many, maybe it's one out of 50, but you'll see a bumper sticker on some people's car that spells out the word coexist. In other words, let's just all get along. And it means the blending of religions coexisting. The reason we know that is because the bumper sticker word coexist takes the symbols of Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, and I don't know, one or two other religions, and it uses those symbols, those logos, to spell out the word coexist. Pluralism is the potpourri kind of faith, where people pick this group or that group, and they form their own kind of hybrid faith. It's all over the place in our world today. Sadly, this sort of thing has also been going on in our nation's capital for many decades. You know, we've been patting ourselves on the back that we're some kind of Christian nation. I don't know, maybe for a couple of years in the very beginning of our history we were, but not much long after that. We certainly haven't been in my lifetime, and I suspect in most of yours, even though you may think that. I mean, how would it look any different if we weren't a Christian nation? In Washington, D.C., there are, for example, various prayer breakfasts and occasions for prayer gatherings that promote this kind of religious pluralism. And they'll bring together the representatives of Hindu and Buddhist and Islamic and other faiths, say, to pray for the incoming president. I've referenced this before, but one of the more famous efforts like this was, I think it was in New York City in Yankee Stadium or one of the big stadiums right after 9/11, where Oprah Winfrey brought together, sponsored this big prayer gathering, and there were representatives from 50 or so different religious groups, and they were all coming up to a podium and praying to their gods. Some of you may recall and know about the rock star, the rock singer Tina Turner. Well, she once told her fans, and I'm quoting, "I'm a Buddhist Baptist. My training is Baptist, and I can still relate to the Ten Commandments. It's all very close," meaning, you know, Buddhism and Christianity are very similar. "As long as you contact the subconscious mind," she says, "that's where the coin of the Almighty is," end of quote. I'll let you see if you can figure out what that means. Now, our politicians and our rock stars and entertainment people and even some theologians may be into pluralism. That may be something they really like. But let me tell you something. God isn't into it. He doesn't like it. And in the Bible, he tells us, I am a jealous God. You see, friends, this is one reason why early heresies arose to try to claim that Jesus' God was a different God than the God of the Old Testament. And this God of the Old Testament, this mean, old, vengeful Yahweh God, Jesus' God was sort of a guy with flowers in his hair and wants peace and love for everybody. So you've either got to come up with some kind of aberrant, goofy teaching like that, or you've got to believe the unity of Scripture, the whole full orb nature that from Genesis to Revelation, God is the same. God has no intention of sharing his glory or his worship with any other God or any other religion. While preparing this message, I found a comparison of various world religions, and maybe this will give you an idea of how they differ from each other. Eastern religions like Buddhism and Hinduism and Confucianism, well, technically Buddhism and Confucianism, they don't really have a God. They don't really believe in a supernatural deity. So they have no concept of what we would call an afterlife. Hinduism, on the other hand, has a pantheon of gods. They've got hundreds of gods. But they're all very impersonal and uncaring. Hindus also believe, as do some Buddhists, in reincarnation. Islam, of course, is a religion we would be closer to in terms of believing in only one God. And they call their God Allah. And let me give you a little education. Allah is not some special word made up by the Muslims. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. And I can assure you, Arabic-speaking Christians use the same term. So you got to be, it's like we use the word God, it's a generic term. If somebody says, well, I prayed to God, well, you may infer in your own mind they're praying to the God of the Bible, but you don't know that because the word God can apply to any number of things. Well, Islam believes in Allah, an impersonal God, an uncaring God, and it teaches that eternal life is something you have to earn. And essentially, according to Islam, you must do enough good things to outweigh the bad things you've done in life in the hope that somehow you will be admitted into paradise. Sad thing is, Muslims, and I could say there's even some Christians who theologically have this idea, but especially in the Islamic religion, you have no guarantee that God will be nice to you even if you've done enough good things when you die. Now listen, for anybody left in these United States or anywhere else in the world who can still think logically, you can see that if God reveals himself through all world religions, well, you're left with only two possible options regarding the character of God. Either he's a liar or he's schizophrenic. No true Christian can believe in the validity of pluralism or syncretism. Because being a Christian means that we cannot combine Jesus with anything. You either accept him as he is, or you don't accept him at all. There is no middle ground. Well, how do you know that, Dr. Roberts? Well, I'm going to let Jesus tell you himself. In John 14:6, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to me except the Father draws him. And then Peter, speaking to the Jews assembled and even some Gentiles who might have been there on the day of Pentecost, he declared that there is salvation in no one else. And remember, he's saying this in an atmosphere where there were many different gods and religions that were considered legal, official, acceptable religions for citizens in the Roman Empire. He says there's salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. And let me add, that was a revolutionary smack in the face to the Roman government. Because yes, there are all these different legal religions. You could have your own religion in the Roman Empire, but in order to be legal, you had to do one thing in particular. You had to acknowledge the sovereign authority of Caesar and the Roman government over everything, including your religion. And when Peter stood up and he said what is quoted in Acts 4:12, that was a declaration of war, God's holy war against the Roman government and its Caesar and any other government for that matter that pretends to be God. That is the theme right through the New Testament. And for that matter, as I've already indicated, it's the same theme from Genesis to Revelation. Again and again we're told that you cannot be an honest Christian and accept any other god or religion. You can't build a golden calf in the wilderness and call in Yahweh. Now last Sunday I asked us all to consider what some of our golden calves might be. Sad to say, any church can fall into idol worship if they aren't careful. You see our communion table right here? Let's clarify what I mean by that when I say any church can fall into idol worship. Our communion table right there, is what's it made out of? Well, you obviously see it's made out of wood. And there have been times, especially on Sunday evenings, where I have sat down on this table before we started our program. And not one person has complained to me, at least not to my face, that, oh, you sat on the communion table, you shouldn't do that. Well, why should they complain? I mean, it's just a table made out of wood. Now, if I did something like that in the morning service when we're obviously having communion, as we do every Lord's Day, that would be a different thing altogether. And you might have a question mark in your mind. If I showed up here on Sunday morning to preach from this pulpit and I was dressed to go play a tennis match, or I was wearing the workout clothes I wear when I go to the Y. But other than that, these implements have nothing particularly holy about them. It's the use that's made of them. You know, I've seen some churches where the communion table is this elegant, polished walnut engraved with special words, dedicated to the memory of people who paid for the table or donated it. I've seen some churches where the pews, the baptismal font, the doors, the communion chalice, just about every object is graven with the name of some family or some person. Well, that, it seems to me, comes too close to idolatry. You know, that's one reason why most of our Reformed churches are not named after someone. Now, you'll find some like the John Doe Memorial Presbyterian Church, but those are rare for good reason. I mean, I've seen in the PCUS, there used to be, and maybe still is, I don't think they ever changed the name of it, a John Calvin Presbyterian Church, a John Knox Presbyterian Church. All right, yeah, maybe that's okay, but still, we're venerating and memorializing a man or something else other than God in this room that we're in right now. Let me ask you, would Almighty God be okay with us honoring a piece of wood or reverencing a pewter chalice? Let me suggest that if we or any other church get to the point where we have a table that people can't sit on, well, maybe we need to grind it up and put it in the water supply. Now, I want to jump down to verse 29 here. Moses summoning the tribe of the Levites to consecrate themselves to God by standing against their friends and their neighbors and even their brothers and their sons. Standing against those who have taken part in the fertility cult debauchery. Their consecration, the consecration of these Levites meant a stand in battle against those people. Now, there are other translations that say they were dedicated, they were ordained. This was their confirmation, these men, these Levites, into their religious calling. The 19th century Presbyterian Bible scholar George Bush, no relation, thankfully, to the president, he said, and I quote, "This act of obedience on the part of the Levites was a kind of inauguration, though a fearful one, of the tribe into their holy office," end quote. You know, it must have been a major challenge for them. But the Levites were to show no pity. Obeying the Lord was to have priority over all things else. Moses, as he starts down the mountain, he knew already from God what was happening. Joshua, as I said before, he's waiting some distance below, so he doesn't know anything. And as they descended, Joshua, hearing that shouting, he's assumed, as I mentioned, there's an attack on the camp. And as they come down, he sees the sex rituals and the people running naked. And Moses throws down the tablets of stone containing the Ten Commandments, and they shatter on the rocks. Now, as the text indicates, there is some anger and emotion on his part for doing this. But this was not totally an act of anger. It's an act of law. Act of law. The tables were each an identical copy of the legal covenant or treaty between Yahweh God and Israel. There was one copy of the contract for each party. One for Israel and one for the God who established the covenant to be kept in the tabernacle. And notice verse 16. And again, as I said when I read it, this is not just to state the obvious. The point is that this writing was done by the superior covenant partner who decreed the law in the first place. Israel's flagrant apostasy had rendered the covenant null and void, and so Moses has no other choice but to destroy the now invalid contract. And we may at this point take note, as we should, of the courage and the moral fortitude of this man Moses. He's only got Joshua by his side, but he seizes the golden calf. I mean, as I indicated, it probably was a massive thing. He didn't pick it up by himself, but it says that he set it to fire and he grinds it to dust and he makes the people drink the gold dust. See, at any time, the people could have killed Moses and Joshua, but they didn't do anything. And we can speculate that it was perhaps too difficult for them to put up any resistance at this point. I mean, after all, they're standing there naked and ashamed. And I think it's reasonable speculation that during this time of this lengthy fertility cult ordeal ritual thing, various merchants from neighboring tribes and peoples must have seen what was happening. And that's not really too much speculation, because if you look at verse 25, I'm going to read it from a different translation. Moses saw that Aaron had let the people get completely out of control, much to the amusement, that is the derision or the ridicule of their enemies. Plenty of people have seen what they're doing to the point where they're making fun of them. Now, let's not miss the irony here. Those people left Egypt by means of God's supernatural power, and now here they are, rolling on the ground, doing immoral things like the very people they despised. You know, one of the more amusing parts of the story is, you don't even have to be told as we read it, is Aaron's response. Now, his account of what he tells Moses is true. He describes accurately the demands of the people. But to say that he stretches the truth about the creation of the golden calf is a bit of an understatement. Listen to it again in verse 24. So I told them to take off any gold they were wearing. They gave it to me. I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. The Levites are called forward to stand with Moses. They're given the order to go through the camp and execute the guilty. This is what they're doing. This isn't just random, wanton killing. They are bringing God's sanctioned execution against the guilty. Now, according to verse 28, that meant most likely the people who were the main leaders and instigators, about 3,000 people. Now, there's some variance in this, in that 1 Corinthians 10:8 tells us there were 23,000 total who died. Verse 26, we have one of the great challenges of history. One of these questions that echoes down through the centuries. Who is on Yahweh's side? Who stands with Yahweh? Then you come here with me, Moses says. As is very directly implied here, to stand with God also involves doing combat when necessary. As one scholar wrote about this verse, no simple verbal affirmation can be a substitute for faith on the firing line. And as verse 26 makes clear, all the sons of Levi who remained faithful joined Moses. That did not include Aaron. And again, let's not miss the irony. Because earlier in this story, I mean, way back in the beginning of Exodus, we read where God passed over Moses' family and chose Aaron and his descendants for the priesthood. And in terms of that number, 3,000 executed, there may be a judicial reason why it was that many. You know, in many cultures, including the Romans, whenever there was a mutiny or some sort of official rebellion or treacherous action, the penalty was execution. But it had a certain term. How many of you have ever heard if a hurricane or a tornado has blown through some area, and they'll say on the news report, or you hear somebody talk about it, they'll say, that whole area was decimated by the storm. See, decimation, the decimating of an area, or in this case, of people, is a legal term. It literally means the execution of every tenth person. That was the penalty, the legal penalty. And that may be why they were 3,000. Aaron was frankly more fearful of the people than he was of the power of Almighty God. You might say that in his case, he acted quite pragmatically rather than religiously or theologically. You know, he's thinking to himself, well, okay, I can either be faithful to God here and not do this crazy thing with the calf and all the fertility cult stuff, or I can give these people what they want and live to tell about it on another day. And I'll just I'll deal with Moses later. That's called practicality, being pragmatic. You know, if there's been one thing that has been characteristic of both church and state in our time, it's been that very thing. The cowardly, pragmatic compromise over covenant fidelity. Men want deliverance, but at the risk of other men's lives, not their own. Someone well observed, pragmatism can be as much an idol as anything else. What had been, at least our own nominally Christian society, has been largely destroyed because of the cowardice and the weak moral character of the people and the leaders that we and our ancestors have chosen. Of course, there's never been a time when these things didn't have to be resisted. But what makes the difference in any society is the presence of men of faith and courage and character. A good society is not born out of cowardice. And where there is no courage, there is no faith. And leaders in all spheres of society bear a particular responsibility to be stridently faithful to God's law word. Now, in this case, it certainly appears that it was the people who initiated the apostasy. Look again at verse 25. It was Aaron's fault. The people, though, went wild and got out of control. And as I mentioned last week, Deuteronomy 9:20 indicates that only the intercession of Moses saved Aaron from certain death. And just as there had been a test between Moses and Israel, so now there's also the testing of both Moses and Aaron. Moses clearly gives evidence of a courageous faith. But Aaron shows himself to be a coward, frankly. Moses is the one, even in his strident fidelity to Yahweh, who showed more love for the people than Aaron. You might think, well, how is he showing love to the people by telling the Levites to go kill 3,000 of them? Well, if you look down at verse 32, you see that Moses actually offers to give up his own salvation for the people. Aaron offers nothing. And this is where it all comes right down to us this morning, my friends. I mean, up to this point, it's interesting biblical redemptive historical history. But what about us? Let me tell you a story before we close. And this is a parable type story. It's not to be there are elements of it that are not meant to be taken literally. According to the parable, the pastor of a large church, a big steeple church, had a dream one night, and he dreamt that he could see his congregation at worship on Sunday morning. But there was something very strange happening. The choir was in the choir loft. Their mouths were open, but not a sound was heard. The congregation opened their mouths to sing, but nothing came out of their mouths either. And the pastor got up to preach. He opened his mouth, but nothing came out. This was absolutely no sound at all during this worship time. And then, though, he noticed he heard a voice. It was a little girl up in the balcony singing Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound That Saved a Wretch Like Me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I'm blind, but now I see. Well, at that point, the pastor suddenly woke up from his dream. He got up out of the bed. He got on his knees and said, Lord, what was I dreaming? It doesn't make sense to me. And the Lord answered him, you have seen a picture of what I see in your church every Sunday morning. The people are singing, you are preaching, but I don't hear a thing. Your heart is not focused on me. You're all focused on yourselves. The only one I heard in your church last Sunday was the little girl in the balcony. And so, friends, what kind of noise are we making? What kind of sound? Is it the sound of true worship? And are we worshiping Yahweh God alone? And for our sakes, let it be the sound of a congregation that refuse to worship anything or anyone else. Let us pray.